to explain that supersymmetric gauge theories can be put on, first of all, round three sphere, and its deformation called the squashed three sphere and the ellipsoid. And the Suzy gauge theories on round three sphere has been studied first by Kapustin's company, and their analysis has been recently generalized to full arbitrary n equal to supersymmetric theories by Jafferis and independently by my company. And the round three sphere is, as you know, defined by this embedding equation into round flat R4. Flat R4 has this metric. And then L is the L determines the size of S3. And if you use the equivalence of S3 with the SU2 group manifold, we can write the metric in terms of SU2 left invariant one form in this manner. And here I'm using gamma as Pauli's matrices. And there is a generalization of this metric to this called the squashed three sphere. And it turned out last year that one can put supersymmetric gauge theories on this kind of manifold once we allow to turn on a certain background vector field at the same time of deforming the round metric. And also, it turned out last year that one can put Suzy gauge theories on ellipsoid. Ellipsoid is defined in the same embedding equation as above, but the ambient R4 space has somewhat inhomogeneous metric with two length parameter L and L tilde appearing here, so that as soon as L and L tilde are not the same, that metric is not round. Yeah, so I will show you how to construct supersymmetric theories on these manifolds. So here is my plan of the talk today. First, I will identify the supersymmetry by analyzing the Killing-Spinner equation. And second, I will show you the construction of supersymmetry transformation law and Lagrangian by Nader kind of method. And finally, I will show you explicit computation of a partition function using supersymmetry localization principle. Right. So let me begin the analysis of supersymmetry on curved manifold. I begin by a three sphere. And it is known that supersymmetry is in correspondence with the conformal Killing spinner. And conformal Killing spinner, by definition, satisfies this Killing spinner equation, where the covariant derivative of Killing spinner field has to be a gamma matrix multiplied onto some other spinner field, epsilon tilde. And here, the covariant derivative is the sum of ordinary derivative and the coupling with the background curvature through the spin connection. So this defines the Killing spinner. And if we analyze this Killing spinner equation on round three sphere, then it's an easy exercise to find that there are two Killing spinner, two solutions to this equation satisfying this, where the epsilon tilde is a 2L, I over 2L times the original Killing spinner. And there are two other Killing spinners satisfying the similar equation with minus sign here. So altogether, on a round three sphere, we have four independent Killing spinners. And any curved space which admit Killing solution to the Killing spinner can support rigid supersymmetric theories. For example, when one can find the Killing spinner on S2 times S1, so that one can define supersymmetric gauge theory on it. And this setup can be used to compute the superconformal index using path integral formalism. Right. And there are several generalization of this equation found last year. The first generalization is this. So last year, our group has found that on ellipsoid, which is defined by these equations, can admit a supersymmetric gauge theory. And if you analyze the ordinary Killing-Spinner equation, as I have shown here, then this ellipsoid doesn't admit a solution. But as soon as we turn on non-zero background vector field in a suitable manner, then we can find a charged Killing-Spinner, which is a solution to this equation. In comparison to the previous equation, we have this dependence on the background gauge field. So this new Killing-Spinner equation is for the Killing-Spinner which couples to this background gauge field in a minimal manner. Right. So here, so this V is the background gauge field which couples minimally to this Killing-Spinner so that V can be regarded as the gauge field for U1R symmetry. So U1R symmetry rotates the supercharges. And the same charged Killing-Spinner equation turned out to have solutions also for the squashed three spheres. So that one can make use of this the solution to this Killing-Spinner equation to define a supersymmetric gauge theory. And in this background, depending on two length parameter L and L tilde, I define the squashing parameter in this manner. B is the square root of ratio of L and L tilde. So there is yet another generalization of the Killing-Spinner equation found last fall by Imamura and Yokoyama. And they studied this squashed three sphere, whose metric is given by this. So here, S has to be chosen to be smaller than 1. And then if we analyze ordinary Killing-Spinner equation, then there is no solution. But as soon as we turn on a background vector field and modify the Killing-Spinner equation like this, then if you choose the background vector field in a suitable manner, then this Killing-Spinner equation turns out to have a solution. And by making use of the solution to this equation, it turns out that we can define a supersymmetric gauge theory. So notice the difference that we are talking about somewhat different generalization of the Killing-Spinner equation. In the previous transparency, the vector shows up in a standard minimal coupling manner, but here the coupling is rather exotic. And then for this background, I define squashing parameter B by this combination. The real part S is appearing here. S is smaller than 1. And the imaginary part T is appearing here. And T is defined by this equation so that B is of unit absolute value. And then in the following, I'm explaining how to compute the partition function for various gauge theories on these two backgrounds, ellipsoid and squashed three sphere. And then the result will depend depend on this squashing parameter B in a non-trivial manner.
These mu's are 3-1 forms, sort of SU2.
Yes, mu's are SU2 left invariant one forms.
Excuse me. So in the generalization that you proposed, you can think of B as being a background gauge field for the U1R charge, U1R symmetry. Is there a similar interpretation for the Imamura?
This one?
Yep.
Yes, there is a similar interpretation. And actually, the way Imamura and Yokoyama found this modification is by going through the dimensional reduction from four-dimensional gauge theory defined on S3 times S1. Mm-hmm. And in dimensionally reducing to three dimensions, they implemented somewhat twisted dimensional reduction so that as one goes along the periodic direction once, we walk a little bit along the S3 direction.
I see.
Yeah, and then if we do this kind of twisted compactification, we get this kind of.
So that's sort of a remnant of a non-trivial spin bundle on the.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So after having discussed a few possibility for generalization of Killing-Spinner equation, the natural question is whether there are any other three manifolds admitting supersymmetry, or whether there are any other variation of Killing-Spinner equations. And one can, of course, ask a similar question in higher dimensions, like 4 or 5 dimensions. And in thinking about such questions, an interesting observation made by Festucci and Seiberg last year is that Killing-Spinner equation is similar to Gravitino's transformation law in supergravity. So that a supergravity will be a natural framework to explore the possibility of this kind of generalization. Right. So this is the explanation about the supersymmetry on curved manifold. Are there any questions?
I mean, what's your proposal? I didn't read this paper, but I mean, this guy. So, do they classify some like a manifold which admits a Killing-Spinner by using supergravity?
So on a round sphere, the Killing-Spinner equation is simple, but as soon as we deform the background geometry, we need to introduce this or that background gauge field or some other field. And then,
which is probably in the observed in the supergravity.
Yeah, so in general, it's hard to tell what kind of auxiliary field we have to add. And then the natural reference we have to look is the official supergravity. That's their idea. And then let's move on to the construction of three-dimensional n equal 2 supersymmetric gauge theories. So today I would like to focus on n equal 2 SUSY theories, which is the direct dimensional reduction of four-dimensional n equal 1. So the multiplet structure is very much like four-dimensional n equal 1. So we have vector multiplet and chiral multiplet, and vector multiplet is labeled by Lie algebra, whereas chiral multiplet is labeled by representation of G as well as the U1R charge Q. And then vector multiplet contains a real scalar and spinner and vector and auxiliary real scalar field. And those numbers are the R charges of the fields. And the chiral multiplet contains a complex scalar, spinner, and auxiliary complex scalar field. And here I have a degree of freedom to choose the R charge of the lowest component. And here I chose phi to have minus Q R charge. And then if you do so, then psi has to have 1 minus Q. F has to have R charge 2 minus Q. So these are the ingredients to construct SUSY gauge theories. And the construction of supersymmetry transformation law and Lagrangian is a kind of straightforward application of Neta kind of procedure. So we know, assuming that we know the transformation law and Lagrangian on flat R3, one can rewrite every formula in a general covariant manner, and then see whether the transformation law and the Lagrangian works. And then if it doesn't, one can try correcting them by addition of terms which are inversely proportional to the radius or inverse radius squared. OK. So if you do this procedure to the ellipsoid with charged Killing-Spinners, we find the following result. So we have vector multiplet and chiral multiplet. The transformation laws are given like this. So the terms without the shading are the terms which already exist in the theory on flat R3. And these shaded terms are new to the ellipsoid. And similarly, for chiral multiplet, the transformation law becomes like this. So we have to add some new terms.
So those are for, I mean, just pure S3, not this question.
Not only S3 as well, but also a squashed sphere and ellipsoid.
The derivative contains some like a background
edge. This of
in the case of the
squash. Yes. For ellipsoid and the squash three sphere, uh-huh. The spinner field epsilon and epsilon satisfies a charged version of Killing spinner equation, so that the covariant derivative which shows up here and here contains the background gauge field. Right. And then the supersymmetry invariant quantities can also be constructed in a similar manner. So here is the Jahn-Mills supersymmetric completion of Jahn-Mills term and also the matter kinetic term, which are gauge invariant. And notice that dependence on the R charge assignment for matter fields shows up in the transformation law as well as the kinetic Lagrangian, so that the resulting partition function will be a function of R charge assignment.
What's
F? Small f.
Yeah, small f. Sorry.
Small f is the quantity which appears in the definition of Killing spinner equation. So on round sphere, we had 1 over L here.
Okay.
So on a squashed sphere or ellipsoid, we have some more complicated function of coordinate.
F. It depends on B.
Yes, B.
B
it depends
L.
on, yes. Okay. So there are some other supersymmetry invariants like Chan-Simons term, Fayette-Leopold term, and superpotential terms, but we omit. I will not talk about it.
Could you go back to, so those like a colored term are absent on the flat space, right?
Or yeah, colored terms are absent.
But you put those terms, okay, by some like checking perturbatively.
Yes. So what we have to make sure is that the commutator of two supersymmetry is closed under the bosonic symmetry.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah. So in order to get this,
uh-huh.
Those terms are necessary.
Okay. But because theory is not conformal, I don't know. It's hard to determine this symmetric transformation of Lagrangian. My mind.
Sorry, those terms would be there even in flat space if you allow for conformal transformation, super conformal.
If we include super conformal transformation, then epsilon, the spinner field, contains pieces, constant piece and linear piece.
Yes.
And then the derivative of epsilon is non vanishing.
Yeah,
so that these terms are, I think, necessary. Okay. Then there is an important remark about these two supersymmetric invariant quantity. Jahn-Mills Lagrangian and Matter Lagrangians are both supersymmetry exact, which means no matter what direction of supersymmetry we choose, these two Lagrangians can be written as a supersymmetry transformation of some fermionic quantity. And these two equations are guaranteeing this claim. So this SUSY exactness of these two quantity will be used heavily in what follows. So now I move on to the computational partition function. And then in doing so, our strategy is supersymmetry localization principle. So which states that non-zero contribution to path integral arises only from saddle points, which are by definition bosonic field configurations satisfying this condition, which says that supersymmetry transformation of all the fermions are vanishing. And then if you recall that Yamil's Lagrangian, Mata Lagrangian are both written as a supersymmetry transformation of some fermions, then these two can be regarded as the left-hand side, so that L Yamil's, L Mata have to be both vanishing at saddle point. And then if you recall the Yamil's Lagrangian, then the bosonic part is written as a sum of complete squares, as you can see, so that F mu nu has to vanish, D mu sigma has to vanish, and D plus sigma over F has to vanish. So the saddle point is characterized by this equation. And if you do the similar thing to Mata Lagrangian, then we conclude that scalar in the Mata multiplet, auxiliary field in the Mata multiplet, both have to vanish.
But is it possible that the saddle point is not real and then this argument of sum of squares doesn't work?
You mean the possibility of saddle point, existence of saddle point away from the integration contour?
Yeah,
or something
it's just
like
typical
that.
Situation.
Yeah, I haven't thought about the possibility fully carefully, but I guess there is no such possibility. So by working out two specific examples of this equation, we get this condition, and then yeah, sorry, I haven't thought about it. So just let me move on.
Can I ask what's the origin of this principle? Is it a theorem in something, or is it a guess?
I'm not sure about the origin, but so usually if you do have to integral over the bosonic as well as fermionic variables, then if the integrand doesn't contain, if the integrand doesn't depend on any one of the fermionic variable, then the integral automatically vanishes because the fermionic integral when eta is a fermionic coordinate, then if the integrand doesn't contain eta, then the integral automatically vanishes. Then suppose we are focusing on one direction of supersymmetry, and there is a fermionic coordinate which parameterizes this direction of supersymmetry. Then if there is one fermion for which the right-hand side is non-zero, then we can change coordinate so that one of the fermionic coordinate is the direction of supersymmetry. And then if you do that change of coordinate, then the integrand doesn't depend on the eta, so that the integral automatically vanishes. But there are some points in the domain of integration where this change of coordinate doesn't work. So this change of coordinate doesn't work if for any for all the fermionic coordinate, the supersymmetry transformation is vanishing. that's
So what you're ignoring these points is that? I didn't understand the last remark. You said there's some points where the change of coordinates doesn't work. Oh, you mean the points where it's.
Yeah. So the non-zero contribution.
The saddle points are the points where.
Yeah. Yeah, the saddle points are the points where change of coordinate doesn't work. So only from those points, we may get the non-zero contribution to the integral. That's my rough understanding.
So it's a theorem, then you're saying?
Oh, sorry?
In some sense, this is a theorem. The Susi localization principle is actually a theorem, in some sense.
In some in some sense, yeah.
Does it then mean you don't even have to look at one loop terms around the saddle points?
So the path integral localizes onto saddle points, and then some of the integration variables parameterize those saddle points, and there are other variables, and we do have to integrate over those variables. So for integral over everything except for the coordinate on the saddle point locus, we do have to integrate, but for those integral, Gaussian approximation is exact because everything localizes onto saddle point locus. And then a standard argument which guarantees this exactness of Gaussian approximation is that the value of the partition function doesn't change under the shift of the original action by an arbitrary constant multiple of a Susi exact quantity. And this Susi exact quantity has to be satisfying this. And as we have seen, both Yamil's Lagrangian and Mata Lagrangian are of this class. So that starting from original Lagrangian, we can add arbitrary large constant multiple of this guy and this guy. And then the problem reduces to infinitely weak coupling problem, so that the Gaussian approximation is exact. And then if we summarize all these statements, then we will arrive at the matrix integral formula, which states that the partition function can be computed as an integral over finite dimensional space, which is the Lie algebra. We can make use of the symmetry to reduce the integration domain to Cartan subalgebra. And if the classical Lagrangian takes non-zero value on the saddle point locus, we have to add this term. And this happens when the original Lagrangian contains Chan-Simons term. If there is Chan-Simons term, then the K times S Chan-Simons is K times sigma squared. And if there is Fy term, then it gives rise to a term linear in the sigma. And finally, we have to add the one loop determinant, which arises from the Gaussian integral.
Sorry, how does the delta Susi look like? Is it like an action of just 3D base
theory? So I said that L Yamils can be written like this.
Like this, okay. Yeah. But not exactly the same.
L Yamils can be written like this.
Okay. So delta exact.
Yeah, L Yamils is delta exact. So that the partition function doesn't depend on Yamils coupling. Yeah. In the sense that it doesn't depend on certain couplings, yeah.
Even on S3 or something.
Okay. Yeah, so the most difficult part of the computation of partition function is the evaluation of one loop determinants. Determinant of delta B or delta F, where this delta B or delta F can be read off from Diamir's Lagrangian or Mata Lagrangian in a quadratic truncation.
Can I go back to this question about the complex saddle points and so on? So it seems to me that the way you prove the theorem, you say you never have to consider complex saddle points. You only have to consider saddle points in the domain, original domain of integration. Is that a fair statement?
One can analyze the problem of solving this equation for all the fermions and find out the solution. And some of them might not be on the domain of integration. But if we analyze this equation for the problem of our interest, all those saddle points are on our domain of integration.
But suppose there was a saddle point that wasn't in the domain of integration. Shouldn't you just ignore it? I thought you just proved that the only contribution can come from saddle points that are in the domain of integration.
Well, normally the saddle points are not on the domain of integration.
Normally they're not. That's right. But normally it's not the case that you get zero contribution everywhere away from the saddle points. But if I understood the argument here, it was that you would. That's precisely what it said. And it doesn't mean you can't go off the domain of integration, but it seems to me that what you said would claim that you need not go off the domain of integration, the original domain of integration. Because you claimed that everywhere except in a neighbor of saddle point, there's zero contribution. So for example, if there were no saddle points in the original domain of integration, the answer would be zero. I mean, it's different from the usual situation, but I thought that was what you were claiming. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in any case, I didn't find any saddle point which are away from the domain of integration, so.
Okay. But that's not saying they don't exist, right? But I thought you were
essentially can explain why one shouldn't go outside the domain of integration. Why that it's already very separate because there are no other
saddle. That would explain it also, but
yeah. Right. So we have to compute the determinant. So the direct way to compute the determinant is to work out the full spectrum of those kinetic operators. And then when the metric is either round sphere or squashed three spheres, for which the metric can be written in this way, then it is natural to set the field bind to be L times mu 1, L times mu 2, and L tilde times mu 3. And then if we make use of the inverse field bind to define this kind of vector field, then it turns out that these vector fields are proportional to the generator of SU to right action. So that our full spectrum of those kinetic operators can be obtained using three-dimensional spherical harmonics. And here is the example. For electron chiral multiplet coupled to abelian vector multiplet in n equal to super QED, the kinetic operator for phi and psi, bosons and fermions, look like this. For bosons, the kinetic operator is just a quadratic Casimir of SU2, easy to work out the spectrum. And for fermions, the Dirac operator look like just a spin orbit interaction. Again, it's easy to work out the spectrum. And if you do the same thing for squashed three sphere, then the expression becomes a little bit messy, but still, those are both written in terms of the orbital angular momentum operator and the spin angular momentum operator, so that the spectrum can be worked out by a brute force. But for ellipsoid, which is defined by this embedding equation in a non-homogeneous R4, the metric turns out to preserve only U1 cross U1 symmetry, so much smaller than SU2, so that a full spectrum for those kinetic operators is too difficult to work out. But if we are only interested in the ratio of the one loop determinant like this, then what we have to care about is only the mode which doesn't sit in a super multiplate. I mean, the modes which doesn't have super partner, so-called unpaired eigenmodes. And those modes are all characterized by first order, some kind of first order differential equation, so that it is relatively easy to work out the full spectrum of those unpaired eigenmodes. And then once we get this spectrum of these unpaired modes, then it's a straightforward task to compute this. And then here is our result. The partition function of three-dimensional gauge theory on ellipsoid. The partition function is a finite dimensional integral, and the integral, the domain of integration is the Carlton subalgebra of the Lie algebra. And we have the one loop determinant contribution from gauge multiplet and Mata multiplet. And we may have a contribution from our original Lagrangian at saddle point. And gauge multiplet determinant is product of sine hyperbolic function. And Mata multiplet determinant is the product of a double sine function. And the double sine function is defined as a collection of zeros and poles. Right. And very remarkably, this product of sine hyperbolic function and this double, double sine function make their appearance very often in G Toda theory. And the B can be interpreted in this context as the Toda coupling.
But later, is this product is convergent?
Whether this is convergent or not? I think it's convergent. Yeah, so enumerator, denominator both becoming larger and larger, but once we divide out by MB plus NB inverse. Enumerator and the denominator.
So it looks like it's log diverse.
Still log diverse. Well, then some zeta function kind of regularization might be.
But you can't regularize log divergence with zeta. Okay, it's fine.
So I said that this coupling constant B has something to do with the Toda coupling. And let's recall what kind of value this parameter B can take. First, we talked the ellipsoid with charged Killing spinners. In that case, B was defined as a square root of the ratio of two axis length parameter. And then if L is bigger than L tilde, B can take values which is greater than 1. And then when B is set to 1, then L equals L tilde, so we go back to round 3 square. And somewhat interestingly, if we compute the partition function on squashed 3 spheres with charged Killing spinners, then the result is that for B equal 1. But if we try the computational partition function for squashed three spheres with modified Killing spinners, which was discovered by Imamura and Yokoyama, B can take a complex phase value. The absolute value of B is 1. So for backgrounds with modified Killing spinner, modified Killing spinners, B can take value from here to here. So this is our result for the exact ellipsoid partition function. Here, are there any questions? No. Then, after calculating this result, I get these questions very often. The first question is about the overall normalization of partition function. The second is whether there are quantum correction, in particular whether we have to care about the shift of the Chan-Simons level. So let me look at the first let me think about the first question about overall normalization. First of all, a matter one loop determinant is correct, including normalization. So there are several ways to check this, but one easy check is to consider the following. Suppose we have a two chiral field, phi and phi prime, phi and phi prime carry R charge Q and Q prime, and the opposite U1 gauge charge plus minus one, and then the contribution from those chiral fields to the one-loop determinant is this, the product of double sine function. But if Q plus Q prime is set to 2, then if we regard this as x, then this turns out to be minus x, and then SB of x and SB of minus x is 1. And this is consistent with the fact that if the R charge of phi and phi prime sums up to 2, then we can turn on a quadratic superpotential deformation so that phi and phi prime can be decoupled altogether from the system. So if we normalize the one-loop determinant from the matter fields incorrectly, then we wouldn't get the value 1 here, so that our normalization for the one-loop determinant from matter is correct. But vector multiplet contribution needs a finite renormalization. And in order to determine the correct overall normalization, the quickest way is to make comparison with the known exact results in pure Chan-Simon theory, which was obtained by Witten in 1989. So let's do so. So here is our integral formula for UN Chan-Simon theory at level k. UN n equal to supersymmetric Chan-Simon theory at level k. So we have unknown overall coefficient c here. So our task is to determine this number. And then by closely looking at this formula, we notice that by expanding this product of Sinch function into sum of exponentials, the expression becomes the product of Gaussian, so that we can explicitly perform the integration. And then if you do so, then we get this formula. And then the result is C times some number times precisely the exact partition function of bosonic SN Chan-Simon theory at shifted level. So the correct choice for the constant C is to make this combination 1. And we are left with the problem of explaining the level shift k minus n. And it turns out that this level shift can be explained by one loop effect. So what was the one loop effect that shifts the Chan-Simons coupling? So let's recall the old work. So in 1995, Cao Li studied the system of Yang-Mills Chan-Simon theory with various extended supersymmetry, for which the Lagrangian is the sum of the Chan-Simons Lagrangian with n SUSY and the Yang-Mills Lagrangian with n SUSY. And then by studying the one-loop effect, they found that the Chan-Simons level gets shifted by this amount, depending on various amount of SUSY. For n equals 0, there is a one loop, there is a loop of gauge boson, and then it shifts the chance times coupling by k. And when n equals 1, there is a contribution from fermion as well as gauge boson, and then the shift of level is n over 2. And for n equals 2 and 3, there is no shift of the Chan-Simons coupling. And in particular for n equals 2, the contribution from gauge boson one loop and the Gaugino one loop is canceling.
So, sorry, could you repeat it? Which way?
The gauge boson one loop contribution and Gaugino one loop contribution gives canceling a contribution. Okay, so Gaugino shifts k by n, gauge boson shifts k by n, Gaugino shifts k by minus n. Right. So having understood this, there are two routes to compute the partition function for n equal to Jan-Mills Chan-Simons theory. So Lagrangian is the sum of n equal to Chan-Simons Lagrangian plus Jan-Mills Lagrangian. And one of the two ways to compute the partition function is to use the supersymmetry localization. And for this, we have to technically set the Jan-Mills coupling to 0 so that this term is becoming dominant and the saddle point approximation is exact. And then we get the matrix integral formula and the remaining integral can be performed as we have seen, and then we get Witten's exact formula with the level shifted by minus n. And instead, if we take the opposite, the other route? So the other route is to set g squared to be very large first, and then in this limit, the fields in the vector multiplet becomes all very massive, and their mass is proportional to k times g squared. And we can think about integrating out all the fields, Gaugino and scalar auxiliary field, except for vector field. And then by integrating out those fields, using this result, the one loop integration of fermion makes the shift of the Chan-Simons level by minus n. So after integrating out all these fields, we are left with bosonic Chan-Simons theory at this shifted level. And then we get, again, Witten's exact formula for Chan-Simons level k minus n. So either way, we get the same result. So finally, I'd like to spend some time to explain application to M2 brain physics. So as we have seen, our final formula for exact partition function on sphere or ellipsoid takes the form of matrix integral. So the large end behavior can be studied by making use of the standard large end matrix model techniques. So here is the example of ABJM theory, which is a theory for n M2 brains moving in the orbifold of C4. And this theory is a UN level k Chan-Simons times UN level minus k Chan-Simons theory with two chiral matters with this sitting in this representation and the two chiral matters sitting in this bifundamental representation and the superpotential. And for computation of partition function, this superpotential is irrelevant. And what is interesting about this theory is that at strong coupling, at strong Tohoft coupling, when n over k is much greater than 1, this model is supposed to be dual to 11-dimensional supergravity on this space or 2-way supergravity on this space. And since this model has been invented, people wondered about the puzzle about the free energy. at weak coupling, the free energy has to scale like n to the square because every field is a n by n matrix in this model. But at strong coupling, the gauge theory analysis is no longer reliable. So by using the supergravity analysis, we find this strange scaling property of free energy. So the problem is how to interpolate n square property in the weak coupling and n to the 3/2 property at a strong coupling. And to do that, yeah, so before going into the formula for the ABJM partition function, we first recall that for supersymmetry greater than 3, matters form hypermultiplet, which are pairs of chiral multiplet with opposite charge and R charge 1/2. And then if you compute its one loop determinant on round 3 sphere, then it's a product of double sine function at the value b equal 1 and q equal 1/2. And this is nothing but 1 over cosh. So if we make use of this result, then the ABJM partition function looks like this. So this is a formula for ABJ model for which the gauge group is UN1 cross UN2. So we have N1 plus N2 integration variables. And here we have a one loop determinant from gauge multiplet. Here we have one loop determinant from matters. And here we have chance, the classical action contribution. And as I said, this integral is was derived from a matrix integral so that we can apply a standard Tohoft expansion of the free energy. Then if we do so, the free energy is a series in a string coupling, which is essentially an inverse of Chan-Simons coupling. And FH is a summation over all the Feynman diagram of the topology of genus G. Genus H surface. And FH is a function of this Tohoft coupling. And then, so in the limit of large N, standard eigenvalue distribution analysis can be used to determine the planar, the planar limit of the free energy. And then Drucker and Marino and Putrov did this to find this scaling property of free energy at strong coupling.
Sorry, so the sign of a new square in the exponent, what does it mean?
This one? The sign of?
Don't look again, convergence. Sorry, in PK.
Ah. Yes, it doesn't look, yeah, so originally GS was pure imaginary, so that, obviously saddle point is not that, Yeah, if you follow the standard eigenvalue distribution analysis, then I remember that the eigenvalues are localized at the origin, although wrong sign. So, after the seminar. So my time is up. So yeah. So let me conclude. So today I explained how to compute the exact three-dimensional partition function on three sphere and its deformation. And I couldn't explain various interesting identities of double sine function. But those things will be useful for better understanding of M2 brain dynamics or a three-dimensional version of AGT conjecture or proving various three-dimensional dualities. Yeah. So that's all. Yeah, thank you very much.
So is the computation of the partition function is equal to the domain wall on the S3 and inside S4 can be considered in the theory. Then which is equal to some like a very loop operator in the DB field, right? Mm-hmm. Then probably you found a correspondence in the SU2 case.
Yeah.
But is there any obstacle to compute a little operator in the total field?
I think fairing the operators in all the higher end TODA theories has been worked out by John's work.
And did it correspond to what they obtain?
For a particular field.
Oh. And the other question is that this shifted with transcendental level is it only one loop contribution? Is there any two loop or three loops contribution?
I don't remember well, but in the old paper by Coleman,
uh-huh.
So
one loop.
Yeah.
Only is there any proof?
I'm not sure about the proof.